Sahana bhavatu, sahana punaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
I want to, every class will have a guided meditation, but I also want to kind of orientate you a little bit and teach you about meditation, what we call nididhyasana. Nididhyasana, or contemplation, where we're really allowing our mind to sit with what we understand at the time of teaching. It's really not about gaining a new experience. It's about recognizing myself that's already here. And so the whole teaching, we talked a little bit about this in satsang last night, the whole teaching of the Vedanta is to help you to recognize and differentiate kind of your beautiful self, the self which is not changing, that's very nature, is an absolute shanti. So we have to talk about what shanti means, but an absolute well-being, a peace, absolute peace, where all is well with me. That's your nature. That's who you are. But the mind isn't always like that. And the mind and the self get very confused, because that's our situation. We mentioned this a little bit last night. Your mind, it's a beginningless ignorance that we suffer from. Just like the dream character I brought about, that example. It's a beginningless ignorance where the mind, because your mind always enjoys you and has you as its self, the mind takes itself to be you. Whereas in fact, it's kind of true. If I use the clay pot example, you know, the pot just assumes that it is clay, which is true. If there's no distance, if you have a clay pot, there's no distance between the pot and the clay. And so if the pot says, I am clay, it's correct. It is completely clay. It is nothing but clay. But from the standpoint of the clay, there isn't even a pot. There's only clay, right? And so the clay has a different relationship with the pot than the pot has with the clay. The pot is totally dependent on clay, and it has no reality other than the clay. But for the clay, there's only clay. And so I have kind of that type of distinction between my own being, my own presence, and then this nature of the mind which enjoys me completely but doesn't really bring about any change to me. So this is really fundamental. It's called satya mitya, this relationship where I am actually totally free of any type of change or ashanti, lack of shanti. But my mind, which totally 100% depends upon me, is capable of all kinds of things. Right? It's capable of all different types of thought modifications, all different types of emotions. I can be in pain, I can suffer, I can be depressed, I can be hurt, I can be happy, I can be elated, I can be bored, I can be any number of different types of thought modifications are there, some of which are not what I would choose. Now, there's some states of mind where I don't feel whole and complete, and that all is well with me, you know. And I don't have any control over it. That's what we find. I remember when I was in my teens, I would be really afraid of my mind. I would be fine 1 minute, and then I'd just be walking along, innocently walking along, and something would happen. Something would trigger me. And then I would be hurt or angry or something, some emotion would overwhelm me, and then it's not like I could say, okay, that's enough of that. So I would just have to wait it out. And so that's the tremendous power of the mind. Then you wait it out, and then you're back to relative normalcy. And then something else overwhelms you, you know, and you have to wait it out. So the mind is capable of really taking us on a lot of rides. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna talked about it to Krishna, and he said, my mind is like a ship at sea. you know, and it's just getting knocked around by the waves, and I have no control over it, you know. What can I do? You know, what can I do to control this mind? And for me, until a person has self-knowledge, the self and the mind are one and the same. Well, actually, that isn't true. They are one and the same on one level, just like the clay and the pot are one and the same. But they're one and the same in kind of a different way, where the reality of the pot is a different reality than the reality of the clay. The pot has no being apart from the clay, and the clay is totally independent of the pot. So it's a really unusual relationship. That's my relationship with the mind, my being, me, and I'm totally independent and unaffected by my mind. But if I'm only viewing myself through the lens of my mind, there is no self, there's just a mind self. There's no differentiation there. And so we're not at all talking about gaining a new experience. We're talking about differentiating the content of the experience that we have right now, which is myself, kind of like the clay. I am here completely 100%. And I am totally identified with that, my mind totally identifies me with itself. That's the problem. It's not that I'm not here. It's not that the mind isn't here. It's that that discrimination is lacking until it's not lacking. You know? When it's not, once that discrimination is there, then your mind thinks, how is it possible? How is it possible that I could confuse these two things? In fact, Shankara, in his, it's called the Adhyasabhasha, it's the introduction to the Brahma Sutras, which is the last text that you ever study, really. You study all of the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita and all of these explanatory texts called Prakarana Granthas, and then Brahma Sutras is the last analytical text of the whole Vedanta. And in his comment, his introduction to that, he says just that. How is it possible? How is this possible that we don't know this, that we can't see this? It's a miracle. It's something extraordinary, because once you see it, you can't not see it. That's the thing, which is good. That's a really good thing. So our task now is to really become, to see it, to recognize something that's there to be recognized. So I'm saying all this because a lot of times with meditation, we're looking for a new experience. Like I have to have an experience of the self as though I'm not here. You know, so then I'm looking for something. Well, if I'm looking for something, then who's the one? I'm leaving behind the one, the self of the one who's looking. And then that's the one we have to recognize. So we have to recognize the one who's already completely here. It's kind of interesting because when you recognize yourself, you recognize, I've never not been here. I had just totally, my mind had just totally confused me, you know, with itself. And so I'm taking on all of the qualities that are actually coming and going. Qualities that are coming and going in me, right? I'm not coming and going. All of the qualities, the emotions, our feelings, they're all coming and going. I'm here. So just imagine this emotion comes, and here I am, and it goes, and here I go. That's not our experience. Right? Our experience is these feelings and things overwhelm us, but then I'm here during the overwhelm, and I'm here when it's gone. I'm here before, during, and after. So that one who never goes is always here, we have to recognize. But now, to recognize it, you have to have an available mind. So that's when we say our prayer, you know, all the prayers we say, they all end with Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Let's talk about Shanti for a minute. We say it three times because the first Shanti is saying, let me have peace in reference to the condition of my body and my mind. Let my body be at peace. You know, like say your knees hurt, you're meditating and your knees hurt, you know, or your mind is upset, then you're not really available because you're overwhelmed by these physical or mental emotional conditions. So let my mind and body be at peace. That's first Shanti. The second Shanti is, let the world not be disturbing me. You know, let there not be, I'll use examples like if you're reading in the commentary, let there be no rattlesnakes, no snakes or bugs or anything. let them all, you know, just keep to themselves, and so that I can just not be invaded by mosquitoes. And then let also, the third shanti is, let the gods, let Ishwar and all the devatas, let them protect me. Let the fates protect me so that I can actually be present. That I can be emotionally present. I can be physically present. That the universe itself isn't dragging me away or taking my mind, you know. So let me have that peace. So what does it mean for my mind? What do we mean to have peace? You know, I'm sure we could all define it probably in very similar ways, but just to make it clear, throughout your day, you know, hopefully, the day is going to be filled with all different kinds of mental and emotional states. Sometimes you're just yourself. Your mind is not upset. It's not really wanting anything to be different. You're just at peace. There's just a sense of well-being. Your mind isn't emotionally upset. It's not distraught. It's not worried or concerned about what you need to do. There can be all kinds of thoughts taking place and even moods taking place, but they're in terms of your own state of being, you're fine. You're just fine. You're just yourself. And that whatever the mind is doing or the environment is doing, it's not pulling away or upsetting you in any way. So you just feel at peace, at rest, you know. And in fact, it's a beautiful state. It's at that time when you really don't want anything in particular, you can just appreciate people and the universe the way it is. So that's in your body. You can appreciate your body. You can appreciate your clothes. You can appreciate your hair. You can appreciate everything is just, it's fine. It's not calling any special attention, you know. So you have that sense of you have that sense of well-being. That's what we mean by shanti. So say when this teaching is taking place, you would like your mind to be like that. Because if your mind is like that, then there's nothing distracting you and you can just kind of relax and be present to the class as it takes place. So that's why we always do at the beginning, like we just did that, what's called a shanti pata. It's a prayer where we're asking for that shanti. So we can just relax and be present. And in this one prayer we do, the Sahana Bhavatu, which is usually the first one we do, it just says simply asking Bhagawan, you know, to protect us. It means protect us, protect this environment, protect us so during this sacred space so that this teaching can take place. And then it says, may Bhagawan nourish us. Bhavatu. Nourish us, it could be physically so we're not hungry or anything, but really nourish us in terms of this knowledge, you know. And then may our mind be present and be alert, and may we have virya, may we have energy, you know, to be able to be physically comfortable and mentally alert. Can we have that virya, you know? And then may we have tejas, may this knowledge that is taking place, can it come into a mind that is filled with tejas, with brightness and alertness? And then between all of us, teacher and student and each other, may there be no animosity, you know? May we not have any problems with each other. Because that's really, if there's a problem, say even between teacher and student, if there's a problem, then you're sitting there worried or in having a negative relationship with the teacher, and so then how can this knowledge take place when really the teacher and the student have to kind of disappear and the knowledge just takes place? But it's also, it's like the only thing happening is that the knowledge. So we pray for that, which I think is really beautiful, that this prayer is thousands of years old. I mean, hundreds of thousands, I don't know, it's very old. So these things are known. These are just human conditions. So we're asking for that relief from that so this teaching can take place. And may we not have any animosity between each other, because you know what it's like to be in a group of people and there's one person in the group that you don't like. You know, it's very disturbing. In fact, if there's one person even on the other side of the world that you don't like, that's very disturbing. So let all that, you know, go. Why so that we had the Shanti? But the world brings about, there's just many, many occasions for our Shanti to be disturbed. And so in gaining this knowledge and being able to hold it, to actually hold this knowledge, we have to learn how to handle our mind. It's not that hard, but we have to learn it. We have to learn it at least from this Vedantic perspective and from a psychological perspective. And so it helps tremendously to just learn some of these things that we're going to be teaching as part of meditation. Learning and practicing for this whole week or whole month, if you're here for the month, so that it becomes just second nature, ways of being with your mind that become second nature, so that your mind can have a natural shanti with or without knowledge. You don't need knowledge for this part of it. You don't need self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is helpful, but you don't need it in terms of learning really how to be with your mind in a way that the mind feels held. You know, with knowledge, we're also recognizing the relationship of my being to the mind, which adds a whole different beautiful dimension. But we also need to, on a relative level, really learn how to be with my mind in a way where it has relative well-being. So there's a lot that we'll be doing in this class. Some of you have been coming here regularly, so some will be repetitive, some will be new. I always feel like it's always new, because you learn something and now you know it, and so then when you hear it again, you're learning it from a different perspective. So we're going to keep developing that so that your mind has the tools that it needs to be able to really be with myself just naturally, you know, and then to hold this knowledge. There's a kind of a story, not a story exactly, but an example Swamiji used to use. I think it's used in, kind of in the Shastra and some of the texts. If you, the example is this, if you want to transport coals, you know, from the fire, you know, from the fire to your hearth, because they used to do that in India, they would go and they would get coals. From somebody who was always keeping the fire tended, they would get coals and then they would take the coals to their home. And so if somebody went to get the coals and they had a nice paper bag. So they took the paper bag and they wanted the paper bag to be filled with the coals, burning coals, right? And so the guy kind of laughed and, okay, and put the coals into the little paper container there. And as he was carrying the container, he made it like 2 or 3 feet, you know, and then the coals just burned right through the paper. So that's our mind until it's not like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I used to remember when you need like a metal, nice, you know, cast iron. You need a nice cast iron pot to transport the coals. And we need a nice cast iron mind to hold this knowledge. I always tell the story of when I was first learning game with Swamiji in the 70s. His teaching was so beautiful. He would just make us all see. So we were all like little jnanis, all enlightened for the hour. You know? It's like everything was so clear and so wonderful. And then I would walk out the door and I would make it 3 or 4 feet. Before my mind started back, and by the time I got to my room, I was just so I remember thinking one time, and it was used to be kind of disturbing, you know, to watch that. I mean, you had no control over it; it just does it. Okay, and you're back. Okay. And so I used to think, someday I'm going to make it to my room, all the way to my room. And it was sometime later, maybe a year later, so I don't remember, but there did come a time when I did make it back to my room. And then I remember thinking, wow, I remember telling myself that I would someday be able to do that. And here I am, I've done it, I've made it clear to my room. You know, that was a nice event. So we want our mind to have the tools that it needs to have that strength, and then with this knowledge, you have a cast iron pot that just holds this knowledge beautifully, you know, and it warms the whole pot. Your knowledge is like that; it just warms beautifully, warms everything, makes meaning out of everything, and your mind, whatever your mind is doing, is fine. And because it's fine, because you can say to your mind, "That's okay. You can be with me." Or, I can, whatever problems that are going on, that's okay, you can be with me. There's no fear. And so your mind just relaxes and is not afraid of itself, you know, not afraid of itself at all, because it has a beautiful home. So we need to work on all of those different aspects of the mind and how to be with our mind in such a way that we have that nice cast iron pot, you know, that can really, really gain and hold this knowledge. It's hard to even gain this knowledge at all if the mind is disturbed or hurt or angry or upset. And so we have to handle both sides. We've got to get the mind, give it the tools that it needs. Actually, these tools that we'll be talking about, I think we should give this to children, you know, so the kids themselves know how to be with their mind instead of being the victim of it. You know, can hold the mind in a beautiful way, you know, to not be so overwhelmed by it. If there's no differentiation in it, we don't know what to do with it. So, with that little introduction, I'm going to go give another little introduction, then we'll do about a half an hour of meditation. Okay. There's some notions, what I call notions, and you can keep those notions if you want to, but I'd like you to give them up for while we're here together, just so that you can experience not having them for a while. One is the notion that I should set a time limit or minimum amount of time that I'm going to meditate. That is a problem because say you say every day, and as though this is really going to help, every day, every morning, I'm going to meditate for 1 hour. Or even say half an hour, which is a long time. Say, I'm going to meditate for 1 hour. I think what happens in that case is that very quickly you stop meditating. Because you don't have time for that hour, you sit down for the hour, that's a long time to sit down. You know, you're not necessarily are going to be able to do that. It becomes almost like a punishment. And we don't need that punishment. We just need to just be with myself. Whether with yourself for 5 minutes or 3 minutes or an hour, it is fine. You are being with yourself. And if you understand it like that, that that's something that you do, you're doing it as you're sitting down, you can do it as you're walking. In fact, meditation becomes, you'll feel, I don't even know when I'm not meditating. You know, doesn't have time limits like this. And by putting on these kind of time limits, you're putting pressure on your mind instead of it being something just sacred between you and your mind or just being with yourself. It's put into like a little box, which I think kind of takes away from what a personal thing it is and that it isn't really about time. So I'd like you to get rid of these kind of time constraints. You can do that later, or maybe with certain types of meditation you have time constraints, but for this one, I want it just to become something that is natural and you don't put these things on it. The other thing is that just most of you are into yoga, so you may have a comfortable asana, or you can sit with your legs crossed for an hour, but most people cannot do that. They don't have the back strength to do that, or your legs are not that comfortable. And so, but you think you're supposed to sit, you know, maybe in a full lotus or something, or in a yoga posture, And so you're doing it because that is the meditation posture. And so then what happens is the body starts getting in your way. You know, because it hurts, it's not comfortable, and your legs are falling asleep, you know, and so then you can't really meditate. The whole thing is a, you know, it's just pressure on how long can I hold this uncomfortable position and meditate. So I didn't want any uncomfortable positions. It's good not to lie down when you meditate, because it even says in the Shastra, we don't lie down because lying down is associated with sleep. And so as you're kind of resolving your mind, you just go to sleep. So it's better if you can, if you need back support or a chair or anything like that, do that. But it's probably better not to lie down. Idea, though, is to put your body is comfortable so that you can let the body go, you know, so that your attention, so that the body isn't drawing attention to itself. So that's important, and sometimes that is something that we get confused about that. So no time limits, you know, and the body should be comfortable, and you can practice your yoga asanas and things when you're doing yoga. And at some point, in fact, we've said, you know, one of the very most important things about yoga is to be able to get your body to a comfort level with an asana, with a position where you can totally be relaxed for an hour, for 1 hour. You can hold it without your knees hurting or anything. But until you have that position, then you have to use kind of a more worldly position that you're used, that your body is used to, so that you can be comfortable. So with that, then now you have a comfortable position and you don't have time constraints that are putting pressure on your mind. And then we can go to kind of another level. And one level is this, that with your conscious mind, we're busy. We have a lot of things to do today. And so now for your mind's perspective, you're going to sit down and meditate, but what about all of these other things that we have to do? You know? Are you sure? are you really sure you want to take this time right now? So then what you do, you acknowledge that, you know. This is just another kind of kindness to your mind. You acknowledge it. You can say, okay, there are a lot of things to do. Why don't you just give me the list of all of your concerns? And then the mind will just rat-a-tat-tat. It'll give you the list, you know, of the things that it's concerned about for the day. These things have to be done. I have to remember to do this. I've got this problem with this person over here. All these things are happening. List it out, and then you say, okay, I know. I will take care of these things. You don't worry about it right now. Okay. Then the mind thinks, okay, she knows what she has to do. Okay, she has her list. And so then that part of your mind will just relax. Now it's more free. Okay. That's the conscious mind. You've taken care of it. There's other levels of conscious mind problems. We'll take care of them. But for now, that's good enough. Then, say the conscious mind is taken care of. We're still going to have to work on all the people that we don't like or who are mean to us in this sense. That's also happening on a conscious level. But before we even go there, okay, we have to know how to be with, I call them the little ones inside. You have to know how to be with your unconscious, you know. And you either know about that at this point in your life or you don't, but they're there. They're there. You can call them in different ways. You can call them like complexes or inner tensions. But because most of our complexes take place when you're really young, you know, before 7 years old, you know, when the buddhi, when your intellect, you know, has choice, the defense system just takes over for you. And every time you've been hurt or embarrassed or shamed or afraid or whatever it is, you know, those things, your defense system just goes and takes it away because you don't have the tools to handle it. So it handles it for you. So it tucks all of these things away and just keeps them there until you're dead. Nothing happens to them if they just project out, you know. Unless you go in and come into relationship with them. And then you can release all of those, what I call those little ones inside, and let them join back into your conscious mind. And that is a huge relief to learn how to do that and to let all of those parts come into conversation with you. It's like they're waiting there for you, just waiting for you to come in and come into a conscious relationship, so all of that energy then can be released and come out into your conscious mind. But you know, until we work on this level, until we work on these things, often a person will experience, when you're contemplating, your mind is quiet, okay? But there's no absorption at all. It's like it's quiet, but pushing against like a vibratory wall. You know, just a... There's no just relaxation into your own being. There's no freedom. Just quiet, like this, you know? And that mind needs to relax. But the mind, the superficial mind seems quiet, but the unconscious is not quiet. And that requires us going in and having some dialogue and learning how to come into relationship with something more than just what's right there in front of you. And so that becomes just a natural way of life. Like Carl Jung, who I've studied pretty extensively, actually, I like him so much as a psychologist. So we have this world, you know, this world, the external world, and we have an internal world, you know, the world of our unconscious, the world of the psyche. And I think that it's a huge loss, actually, to only know about this world and to have no relationship or access with that world of the psyche, the world of the unconscious, which the first layer of it really is what Jung calls the shadow, is all of these little unconscious, those little ones that have been sequestered because we couldn't handle the pain that they went through when they were young. So it's all sequestered, and they're just there waiting. They're just waiting for somebody to come and save them, really. So I mean that actually literally, as though there are parts of yourself that are sequestered and you need to go and get them, right? You need to be a good parent and provide a safe home for all of those little ones inside so that they're free to exist, free to be. Somebody cares. And that creates such a beautiful psyche because we go in a caring way. So that brings up this other important part, and that is what I just briefly touched on last night, that attitude of the inner friend. You know, because say you're talking to the little ones inside, or your attitude toward your body, or your attitude toward your mind is one of a critic, an inner critic, or one who is annoyed or hostile or angry or thinks you're stupid. You know, we bring a lot of stuff with us. Everybody has their own baggage. And part of that baggage is how from childhood we've learned to talk to ourselves. And so often it's either the way we talk to ourselves is either just neutral, which is certainly better than negative, you know. But often it's negative. It's always having something critical to say, or you're not good enough, or, you know, something that makes you feel bad. It's just like in the world, if somebody in your family or somebody in your circle or in your where you work is always critical of you, or doesn't like the way you do this, doesn't like the way you do that, thinks you're an idiot or all this, you know how you feel? You want to leave. You feel badly and you want to leave. You know, you don't want to be around it because it's painful. So just imagine if you picked up from childhood, and you may not even be aware of it, an inner critic. That's the inner environment then. Somebody inside, some, you know, chattering away. So something that's been internalized from when you were young, being a critical voice, you know, or what we call self-hatred. So we don't really have self-hatred. We've internalized that attitude. I'd say if you had a parent or when you were young, a teacher, somebody who's always just did not like you or was always angry, always never thinking you're good enough. You call that self-hatred, but it's really something you picked up. It's you're not good enough. You're not lovable. You're not, you know, you never do anything right. I mean, a little child just is like a sponge. So all of that stuff gets picked up, and then that's how you talk to yourself from when you're one, two, 3 years old, and so you don't even know you're talking to yourself like that because you've never known anything differently, anything different. So we have to become conscious of that and then be able to say, I don't have to talk to myself like that. Yeah. And start learning how to be an inner friend, where you're a person, you become a person to yourself that's like all of the people that you would love to be with. And you love to be with people who love you and who give you the benefit of the doubt, who respect you, you know, who admire you, respect you, care about you. And so we know that in reference to the type of people we like to be around. And we know that's a beautiful way to treat people, even though we don't always treat people that way. We have a value for that. But we never think about it, about how I am with myself. But say, with myself, I'm an inner critic, you know, I'm never good enough. Then that becomes the environment you're walking around in. That's your home. And you can't leave that home. So we can leave our physical home. We can leave our friends and the people that we work with. We can walk away. But you can't walk away from your mind, you know. And so if the way we talk to ourselves or feel about ourselves is like that critic, we have no home inside, no safe haven. And so that means that basically inside I don't have shanti. Shanti means I have a safe haven where I love to be. That's what shanti is. So when I say this, Om Shanti, 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 let me have that safe haven where I love to be. The inner environment, my home, is a safe haven. So we need to develop all of the tools and ways of being with our mind that give us that safe haven so that we can contemplate, right? And come to know that safe haven that is indestructible, right? That you can never do anything about it. You can't make it a not safe haven. That's the nature of your being. But we need a relatively safe haven in order to recognize kind of the absolute nature of yourself, to be able to have that, you know, relationship. So that's what, as human beings, we deserve that. That's who we are. We have to get back to who we actually are, and it's not very hard. It's just we don't know. Yeah. So it would be nice for all these little ones that are coming up. They're going to get so much more than, just because their parents will have that, you know. So it's really, very beautiful. But we can give our little ones inside. They're just waiting to be brought up again. And when you're talking, when we start doing some of this inner dialogue and things that we'll be doing, if you don't know what to say, just think they know what they wish they would have had. what they wish their parents would have said to them, you know. You can give them what you wished you would have had. It's not that you don't know, you do know. Okay, so that's kind of the territory. So we have about 15 minutes. Let's just do a little contemplation.